feeling is via remote.
Protesters once again took to the streets of Belarus Sunday, the latest in nearly a month of demonstrations following disputed elections that left longtime President Alexander Lukashenko in power. Tens of thousands of demonstrators turned out in Minsk today in numbers comparable to previous weekends, waving red and white opposition flags and chanting slogans. Human rights groups have said at least 70 protesters were detained Sunday. Lukashenko, in power since 1994, claimed victory in elections on August 9th. Opposition parties, along with the United States and the European Union, say the poll was heavily rigged. More than 7,000 protesters have been arrested, and widespread evidence of abuse and torture has also been reported. Belarus's main opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, has been in Lithuania since the election for what she says is her own safety. In an interview with VOA, she said she's working to organize new elections despite Lukashenko's refusal to do so. At least 90 people were arrested in Hong Kong Sunday during protest against the postponement of legislative elections. The elections, originally scheduled to be held Sunday, are one of the few times Hong Kong residents get to cast ballots. China's hand-picked Hong Kong leader, Carrie Lam, announced in late July that the city's election would be postponed for a year because of the coronavirus pandemic. The move was widely seen as a blow to the pro-democracy camp, which was widely expected to do well in the elections. Tensions have run high in Hong Kong after China passed a new security law in June, further diminishing the rights of Hong Kongers. For more on these and other international stories, please visit our website at voanews.com or download our easy-to-use app to your mobile device. This is VOA News. Security officials in Tunisia say a police officer has been killed and another wounded in a knife attack in the coastal resort of Sousse. Three assailants were shot dead after the incident, described as a terrorist attack. No particular group has been blamed, but jihadists home from Syria, Libya, and Iraq remain a threat. More than 410,000 Americans could die from COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, by January 1st, according to the latest model by the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in the United States. It added that increasing mask use to the level seen in Singapore, for example, would decrease the cumulative death toll. The model's outlook for the world was even more dire, with deaths projected to triple to 2.8 million globally by January 1st. There are nearly 27 million COVID cases around the world, and more than 880,000 people have died from the virus, according to Johns Hopkins University data. Delegates from Libya's rival administrations met for talks Sunday in Morocco, more than 2 weeks after the two sides announced a surprise ceasefire. The meeting is being held at the initiative of Morocco, which had hosted peace talks in 2015 that led to the creation of a United Nations recognized government for Libya. The talks brought together five members of the Tripoli-based Government of National Accord, or GNA, and five from a parliament headquartered in the eastern Libyan city of Tobruk. Libya has endured almost a decade of violent chaos since the 2011 NATO-backed uprising that toppled and killed veteran dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The crisis worsened last year when military strongman Khalifa Haftar, who backs the Tobruk parliament and is supported by Egypt, the UAE, and Russia, launched an offensive to seize the capital, Tripoli, from the GNA. Haftar was beaten back earlier this year by Turkish-backed GNA forces, and fighting has now stalled around the Mediterranean city of Sirte, the gateway to Libya's eastern oil field and export terminals. The death toll from a gas explosion that tore through a mosque in Bangladesh has risen to 24, officials are reporting Sunday, as rescuers described how survivors jumped into a nearby open sewer to cool their bodies and escape the flames. Worshippers were at Friday evening prayers when fire blasted through the mosque in a town near the capital, Dhaka, emergency services said. The mosque's imam was among the dead. There's been growing anger over the incident after the committee running the mosque alleged the state-run gas transmission firm had earlier demanded a bribe to fix reported leaks more quickly. The remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
So if we say we'll carry on the test in the airport, it will affect arrival experience. So because of that, government is very key in having good arrival experience in Nigeria. We want travelers to be comfortable when they arrive at territory. So that has been removed, that you can go home, do it after a week.
Nigeria announces the resumption of international flights and implement new health guidelines for travelers.
They have formed a group, 5 people from M5 and 5 people from Janta. It's a restrained group, and they have having a discussion in that small group. I think they probably they will come up with some ideas that will be that will satisfy everybody. Probably.
The Malian military junta meets with civil society and opposition political parties.
The only point at which a declaration is required is when the nomination to stand for that public office is filed. And Mr. Hizema has done so repeatedly. And he has, as a matter of fact, explained repeatedly that the privatization process is not the source of his wealth.
And lawyers for Zambia's main opposition leader filed a defamatory lawsuit over accusations of corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria has announced the resumption of international flights to the West African country beginning Saturday. This after Hadi Sirika, the aviation minister, disclosed a list of approved airlines allowed to take off and land. The minister also outlined new medical guidelines to help stop the spread of the coronavirus. He said all passengers must present a negative COVID-19 test result more than 4 days before departure, and they will be tested again on arrival in Nigeria. Local media say so far 10 airlines are not allowed to operate in Nigeria. They include Air France, KLM, Lufthansa, and Etihad Airways. To learn more about the opening of the airports for international flights and new measures to be carried out when visitors disembark from the plane, I reach Mohammed Baban Dede, the Controller General of the Nigeria Immigration Service, or NIS.
Any person who wants to come to Nigeria, regardless if the person is a citizen of Nigeria or not, that person must obtain a negative test before boarding the aircraft. So that's one requirement. This requirement, a legislation is not required because the Minister of Interior and the Controller of General Immigration can stipulate condition for entry into Nigeria. It has been added because the provision is law in law that it has been added as one of the conditions for entry into Nigeria. So there's legal backing for that action. Any person who is coming must obtain negative and is allowed to log in and take also a test 1 week after arrival. Before the opening of the airports, the passports of individuals were being taken by Nigerian Immigration. That's the agency I head. When a person arrives in Nigeria, whether it's a citizen or not, we collect the passport. And until the person conducts a test, he will come and take his passport. But we felt that taking the passport of people who are non-Nigerians, we are taking the passport of our citizen because we are bringing back our citizen back to Nigeria. But this time, people will come from different nationalities. So by the time when you take passport of a migrant, he will feel like he has been detained. So that's why the government introduced a test before boarding and another test on arrival 7 days after arrival. And this compliance is compulsory. If not compliance has been done, the government has the power to take appropriate action.
Looking at the specific measures you put in Nigeria for people to undergo, how robust is this process?
The most important is that those people who are arriving within that 7 days, they have to go on self-isolation. Remember, they boarded this aircraft with a negative test. So almost everybody inside the aircraft is coming with a negative test. But they never can you tell. Probably something can happen. But you know, the possibility is almost 99% that people will arrive with good health into this country because they have done a test from a reliable laboratory before they board. After arriving, they're expected to remain self-isolated for 1 week, during which time they will conduct a second test on arrival. So I think government of Nigeria has taken appropriate effort to make sure its citizens are protected.
We also heard reports that certain aircraft are not allowed to land in Nigeria. Can you explain to me if this is true or not?
The truth of the matter is that government has taken its decision based on facts available to it, probably because of the areas involved in the spread of coronavirus, or probably its citizens have not been allowed to enter that country, or the country borders have not been opened. So there are many possibilities. But all that I can say that as a controller general in charge of immigration, we have allowed people to come in from all categories on board of that aircraft. Suppose you are not a citizen of Nigeria, you are a resident in Nigeria, and your resident permit expired. During this crisis, we allow those people to enter our territory and we give them 90 days to renew their permits. Those who are in our country who have been blocked because they could not travel, they have overstayed. The Minister of Interior has given them a waiver that they don't need to pay the penalty for overstay. As long as the airports are open, we have given them 2 weeks to leave the country. So there is no discrimination in terms of nationality.
Talk to me about the expectations of foreign travelers when they come to the shores of Nigeria following these measures that you've put in place. Because you just said that there would be no discrimination in the policies implemented.
The government of Nigeria was very careful. They didn't open the borders for all the aircrafts because congestion is going to be a key factor in terms of spread of this disease. So the number of aircrafts are limited and they'll be coming on intervals. We have also avoided tests at the airport. That could have caused delay. Immediately when you disembark in an aircraft, you'll be tired, you'll be stressed. So if we say we'll carry on the test in the airport, it will affect arrival experience. So because of that, government is very key in having good arrival experience in Nigeria. We want travelers to be comfortable when they arrive at our territory. So that has been removed, that you can go home, do it after a week. On our side, we have expanded counters. We had almost expanded our counters by half. The possibility, because it will be slow, there will be a gap of clearance. You cannot be very close to your next person you are clearing. So because of the gap provided, we have increased our arrival counters by double. We have protected our officers from having direct contact with the passengers. You know, that is the threat. The immigration officer is one person that you must stop, or you must, when you are going in or leaving the country. And that's a possibility of contact. So we put shields where the direct contact is not there. So I assure people who come to Nigeria, they will continue to have good experience. There will be less delays. We have possibility to monitor our officers to see how their clearance. Previously, they have been 3 minutes experience for clearing a passenger. I assure you we'll monitor to see if that experience for 3 minutes is long, but I'm sure it will not be long because we have spread in the counters. I wish you could come to Nigeria in recent time and see the beautiful airports we have, the friendly officers we have at the airport. I think this will make travelers to be happy when they come to our country.
Mohammed Bamban Dede is the Controller General of the Nigeria Immigration Service, or NIS. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, after a spate of killings in Nigeria's southern Kaduna state, Christian residents, upset with a lack of security in their villages, began standing up to Muslim attackers by establishing their own patrols. The lightly trained guards, armed with whistles and sticks, staffed strategic spots to keep watch and announce any unusual movements in their communities. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from Kaduna state.
Wielding locally made weapons and sticks, some 30 men in this Kurmin Masara village in southern Kaduna chant angrily as they march from house to house on patrol. They express hurt over recent killings by suspected Muslim attackers and are putting their lives on the line to defend their community since it was attacked on August 6. Augustine Y. Caesar is the village youth head. He addresses the men before they dispersed to their duty posts to keep watch. We're not happy with what is happening in our community, he says. These people can kill you with a cutlass and cut you like an animal. The government knows about this and has been quiet, he says. They don't like us. It is now normal for villagers to be on patrol in the village. But apart from the men on patrol, the village is unusually quiet. Farming activities have come to a halt and all the markets remain closed down. 27-year-old Yakubu Nuhu, a local village guard, managed to get his family to safety the night of the attack. He then returned to join forces with other men to protect the village from attackers. But it bothers him that they are outnumbered, have no training, and wield less sophisticated weapons. It was by luck I escaped the attack that night. That's why I joined the group to protect our village. Dozens of people have been killed in villages throughout southern Kaduna in a recent ethno-religious uprising that started in early July. Nigerian authorities responded to the killings by increasing security in the affected places. But protesters who marched in Abuja, Kaduna, and Lagos demanding an end to the violence are also accusing official security officers of sabotage and say they want them withdrawn from their villages. Bivan Magoni, a journalist whose niece was killed in an attack on his village, led the protest in the capital city of Abuja.
Our people are just clerical and auxiliary staff in our own state. We are saying we've had enough. Stop killing our people. Divide our state. If you're not going to stop killing our people, then take away the security that you put in our place, because the coffee is in place and our people get killed at night.
Lawrence Alobi is a retired commissioner of police and security expert. He says he worries about the low confidence levels between the people and security officials.
Without the people, the security community will succeed to the people that they can be able to get information what is happening. Because some of these people even live amongst them, right? So I think that it is important that the security agency should be, like I said earlier, made it worthy for the trust of the citizens. Confidence building.
Three fielding groups in southern Kaduna comprising the Etiap, Fulani and Hausa communities in Zangon Kataf, a restive area in the region, have signed a peace pact and want to establish a joint conflict resolution committee. But until then, local villagers like Yakubu Nuhu say they will remain vigilant. Timothy Ubiezu for VOA News in Southern Kaduna, Northwest Nigeria.
In Mali, the military junta has invited several groups for dialogue to form a transitional government that will lead to civilian rule Saturday. Local media reports the groups include civil society, opposition, and religious organizations. The junta came under pressure from the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, a regional bloc, to hand over power within 12 months. It also imposed sanctions on Mali. The African Union also suspended the country's membership following the ouster of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's government. Both groups have a zero-tolerance policy towards the overthrow of a democratically elected leader. Some Malians say they are hopeful the talks will help to move the country forward. Some, however, say politicians have failed the country, adding that Mali needs fresh leadership. For more on the expectations of the talks between the military junta and Mali's various social and political groups, I reached Salif Tigana, CEO of Tigana Technology in the capital, Bamako.
The military junta declared on national television 2 days ago that they are going to talk to all Malians so that they can set up a world map together with everybody. So they started yesterday going to the two former presidents, General Moussa Traoré. They went to see Atete, and so today they started from the regions to have people talk to regions and make those decisions come up to Bamako and talk with the politician in Bamako. So today is the beginning. I don't know yet what will be the result of discussion that they are going to have with opposition and with the other parties.
But Salif, what are the expectations of the people of Mali since members of the military junta were welcomed as saviors when they pushed out former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's government? Now that they've opened the talk to everybody, what are their expectations?
You know, there is two groups. The group that was with Ibeka, that we call the majority, and there were opposition, which was with the M5. So the people from M5, they want to be more involved in how decisions, what are the decisions to take forward. And the people that were with Ibeka, they don't want the politician to be involved in anything. They want to junta to continue to govern, to do the transition, and then let politicians to come aboard through election. I have a friend in M5 that told me that we should follow the model from Burkina Faso, because in Burkina Faso, they have excluded Blaise Compaoré's party, and many went to the jail. It's only the people in the streets and those who were fighting Compaoré was doing transition with the military.
Do the Malians still support the military junta? Do they have faith in them that they will lead a transition and hand over power within 12 months?
It depends which side you are asking. If you ask, for example, M5, I think M5 is becoming a little bit afraid. I mean, a little bit suspicious of the junta. They like, we started everything. We were doing everything, and the military just come and, you know, to complete the stuff. But now the military is kind of doing things on its own. They decided to make the junta leader a president, which the M5 was very upset about, because they like, you should first discuss with us what to do before you start to do anything. If you ask the M5, they are suspicious. If you ask the people who was in the Ibeka side, those guys are like, okay, since Ibeka is not going to come back, we don't want our ex-enemy or our enemies to be part of anything. You know, they wanted military to continue. Now, if you ask people in the streets, you know, they have lost the confidence on a politician, because they think they are the same. They were in power since 1991. So they're like, these guys, they have already show us what they are capable of, and they're capable of nothing, because, you know, nothing has come up of their 25 or 22 years of governance.
How are people reacting to the demands by ECOWAS that the military junta establish a transitional government? Do you think the military junta will also abide by the demands after they agreed to hand over power in 12 months?
Yeah, in 12 months, I think so, because religious leader, Mr. Diko, they asked Mr. Diko what he think about the duration of the transition, and he said he think 12 months will be okay. And as he is the leader and spiritual leader of the movement, M5, and they respect what he said, so probably most of those guys will agree with the 12-month transition. Now, from ECOWAS, I think the junta is still opposing to the proposition from ECOWAS, like the proposition, like a 12-month proposition. They think it is short for them to implement and, you know, clean the house, or maybe fix the problems they were there before to give power to anyone. So they, I think they are going to go to discussion with M5. One of my friends from M5 told me yesterday that they have formed a group, five people from M5 and five people from Junta. It's a restrained group, and they have having a discussion in that small group. But he didn't tell me what was the discussion about. But I think they will come up with some ideas that will satisfy everybody. Probably.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. Lawyers for Zambian main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema have filed a lawsuit against Edith Nawakwi, leader of the opposition party Forum for Democracy and Development, or FDD. Hichilema is the leader of the United Party for National Development, or UPND, the biggest opposition party in Zambia. The lawsuit, which was filed in a high court in the capital Lusaka, seeks $3 million in damages. The amount is tabulated as legal fees for the main opposition leader, both in Zambia and overseas, where he has business interests. The suit came after Ms. Nawakwi allegedly made defamatory statement against Hichilema during a live radio program. Supporters of the FDD say the lawsuit appears to be a way to silence Ms. Nawakwi following her remarks. But Mulambi Hambi, lead attorney for Mr. Hichilema, tells me that Ms. Nawakwi should present evidence to the court supporting her accusations against his client.
Filed. I'm confirming, yes, that there is a process that has been commenced in the High Court for Zambia for libel against Ms. Nawakwi on behalf of Mr. Hichilema. The background to it is that there are certain allegations that were made by Ms. Nawakwi on public radio, which enjoys coverage across the Republic of Zambia and I suppose internationally because it's available on the internet via live streaming. The allegations were to the effect, one, that Mr. Hijilema is a criminal and a corrupt person on account of what she alleges was his questionable acquisition of a house in Lusaka in an area called Kablonga on Servo Road. She alleges that this house belonged to an entity that was a public entity called Lima Bank. I believe it was Lima Bank Zambia Limited in full, but let's just call it Lima Bank for convenience.
What is Hakainde Hichilema seeking with this lawsuit?
In the lawsuit that has been filed so far, and the claim is relief being sought is one, for damages in libel. Secondly, for an order that Ms. Nawakwi retracts the defamatory words that she uttered. Thirdly, for an injunction to prevent her from uttering further defamatory words, either the very words that she already uttered or words of similar import. Fourth, the claim seeks an order that Ms. Nawakwi reimburses Mr. Hijilema for all expenses that have been incurred on account of him having to mitigate the damages that she has caused by her reckless statements. And the figure has been put to that by estimation, the figure that has been put on account of all the mitigatory work, including consulting legal practitioners globally, where Mr. Hijilema has interest and where his reputation has been tarnished. The figure that has been put to that is $3 million.
Since this lawsuit was filed, it is generating a lot of debate in Zambia. On social media, people are saying that this is just a political discussion and that Mr. Hichilema is taking this too far, and they ask the court case or the lawsuit is meant to muzzle Ms. Nawakwi. What is your reaction to some of these reactions?
To start, it is not intended to muzzle Ms. Nawakwi. It is clear that a court action allows for a controlled way in which each party involved can put forward their assertions and allegations, and a neutral arbiter, a third party in the form of the judge that will determine the issues, will then decide which of the two positions must prevail. Ms. Nawakwi has got every opportunity to put in a defense to the claim that has been filed, and then she will have an opportunity to present her case, to present the evidence in support of her allegation, and it can go either way. So there's no muzzling per se. The essence of taking out court proceedings, as of course many will agree with us, is to give a controlled environment in which the parties can put forward their arguments and there is a determination, rather than allowing for injurious statements to continue.
Some of his critics are saying that the lawsuit is a perfect way to divert people's attention to calls for him to tell Zambians how he became rich. And that because he doesn't want to answer that question, that is why he's using the legal ways to suppress that kind of demand. Since he seeks political office, they want to audit his lifestyle and his business activities to ensure he is clean if they would decide to hand him over the reins of political government in Zambia in the next elections. As his lawyer, what is your reaction to that criticism?
Under the laws of the Republic of Zambia, a person aspiring for public office who remains a private citizen until such point that he puts in his nomination is under no obligation to make a declaration of assets and liabilities. The qualification to that statement is that
the only point at which a declaration is required is when the nomination to stand for that public office is filed. And Mr. Hizema has done so repeatedly. And he has, as a matter of fact, explained repeatedly that the privatization process is not the source of his wealth.
Mulambo Haembi is the lead attorney for Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, in Uganda, the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM, held its primaries to choose representatives of the group ahead of next year's elections Friday. But local media reports there has been violence in some parts of the country. One person was reportedly killed and two others injured following clashes between rival groups within the party. NRM officials condemned the violence but maintains that the elections were held in accordance with health ministry guidelines aimed at stopping the spread of the coronavirus. Opposition groups expressed concern that violence in the NRM primaries could be a precursor to what will happen to opponent of incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his NRM governing party. For a deeper look at the NRM primaries, I read Yusuf Serunkuma in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
First of all, we need to appreciate that the only fair election in this country is the NRM election. It's the election of the party in power. It's the only election that you can give a sense of fairness with less malpractice because, you know, it's the best fighting with itself, all right? So the internal contestations are really the fairest you can have in this election because, you know, it's an internal contestation. But also it's the only election because in most of the primaries across the country, the winners of the NRM primaries often become successful in the general election. All right, so in the build-up is always chaotic and violent, and many present representatives are actually kicked out of parliament, ministers have collapsed. But this is the fairest and most genuine election you can have in this country because it's actually the actual election. Because you have a majority parliament with the NRM representation, you know, so whoever wins the NRM primary automatically becomes the next MP or the next representative. So, you know, it's an interesting election. It's a fair election, so to speak.
Regarding the violence, is this what Ugandans should expect in next year's elections? Because some people are expressing concern that ahead of the elections, they expect violence to increase.
Ugandan elections being violent has become the norm. Maybe from 2001, moments of violence have been recorded across these election cycles. Like we've had maybe four elections between that time. Not any of those elections has happened without violence, right? So, you know, so violence has become a standard norm. But also you need to appreciate that the more a government stays in power, the more unpopular it becomes. So to keep itself into power, it has to execute like more violence onto the electorate. So there's some ways of killing a rat. So governments that stay in power too much to reproduce themselves, they either kill or arrest. All right, if they don't kill or arrest, they intensify violence that's met against those contending against them. All right, so this is expected. It's like, you know, it has to happen because a government has to sustain itself. And because it has become more popular, if it can't buy, it will beat.
So, Yusuf, how do Ugandans feel about what is happening with the Electoral Commission, particularly when the president recently fired some members of the Electoral Commission? How are people seeing this?
Ugandans have lived under dysfunction for a very long time. The so-called Independent Electoral Commission, the head, the commissioners, are all appointed by the sitting head of state, right? So if he even changes just one of the cogs who've been working the Electoral Commission, you know, there'll be maybe one or two column inches in the newspapers complaining, but normally that gets hushed really quickly, right? Perhaps Ugandans know that one of the ways of changing this government is not through an electoral process, right? So, like, they go into the election not because they are interested in having the status quo change. Most of those who are contending these elections are not really looking forward to changing the status quo. They're developing as political subject, but also looking for ways of sustenance.
Yusuf, supporters of the NRM are saying what happened on the weekend
beginning Friday with the NRM internal primary elections shows the party's democratic credentials. What is your take on that?
Okay, now that's a funny question, right? When we speak about a fair electoral process inside the NRM, when we are not speaking about democratic contestations, all right? I don't know by what yardstick we measure the democracy inside the political party, but we're not speaking to internal democratic contestations. We're just speaking about levels of fairness, right? So if the election was outside of, it was between the NRM and the other parties, the levels of unfairness would be tremendously different, right? But we're speaking for internal contestation within the NRM party. That's you know, we're speaking to fairness in a rather different way, all right? So again, it's such a background that, you know, we're speaking to fairness, not in the context of maybe pure refined democracy. I don't know what that means. You cannot put the two words together. You can't put the NRM and democracy together, all right? The most undemocratically run party in this country remains the NRM, all right? So it's difficult for you to say democracy within the party because, you know, the head of the party pronounced, I think ahead of the election, that members of the NRM who are not in the voters' register but have voter IDs or can be identified, like physically identified, but the NRM chairperson of those places where the elections are going to happen, they were free to vote. All right. Now, that's not within the NRM constitution. That is the head of the political party taking a position as the head of the political party. The position is implemented.
Yusuf Serunkuma is a Ugandan political analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Sudanese transitional government has declared a three-month state of emergency after heavy floods affected most of the country. Nearly 100 people have died in the flooding. Officials say they expect the River Nile to continue rising in the coming days and called on international aid agencies for help. For VOA, Michael Atit reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities say 16 of the country's 18 states have been affected by heavy rains and River Nile flooding within the last 2 weeks. After an extraordinary meeting of the Sudan Security and Defense Council on Friday, Minister of Labor and Social Development Lina Sheikh told journalists the country is now a natural crisis region and the crisis declaration will continue for the next 3 months. As Sheikh says, more than 500,000 people have been affected, as more than 100,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged, rendering hundreds of thousands of people homeless and in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. She says 99 individuals have been confirmed dead and 46 others injured due to the impact of the flood.
The Sudanese Security and Defense Council considers Sudan as a natural disaster region and declared a state of emergency in the entire country for the next 3 months. They also established a high committee to deal with the impact of floods across the country.
Last week, the United Nations reported that thousands of Sudanese affected by what is described as the worst flooding in the century are in desperate need of emergency aid to survive. As Sheikh says, the floods have meant 40 schools and nearly 3,000 health facilities are inaccessible to the people. She says authorities expect more rain and so that the Nile will continue rising in the coming days. She said people living near the Nile should move to the higher ground.
The rate of the floods and rains this year, 2020, has exceeded the previous floods that affected the country in 1946 and 1988. We would like to warn here that there are indications and possibilities of an increase on the River Nile in the coming days.
Sudanese authorities also formed a committee tasked with mobilizing local and international support to assist the affected communities across the country. She says, despite the country's limited resources, some local initiatives already are helping affected families and said they should be recognized for their voluntary work.
The council also wishes to take this opportunity to comment on all social efforts that have been taken towards minimizing the impact of floods on our citizens. We here call upon all civil societies, non-governmental organizations, and volunteers to continue and increase their efforts to assist our affected citizens.
Some humanitarian aid agencies warn the flooding will increase the vulnerability of citizens as the coronavirus continues to spread across the country. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Kenya's Peres Jepchechel smashed the women's only race world record in the half marathon in Prague on Saturday. The 26-year-old clocked 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 34 seconds at the Prague 21.1 kilometers, shattering the previous record of 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 11 seconds set by Natasanet Gudeta of Ethiopia at the World Half Marathon Championships in 2018. This was Jepchechel's second world record over the distance. She clocked 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 6 seconds in a mixed gender race in Ras Al Khaimah in 2007, a record that stood for just under 2 months. Meanwhile, Britain's Mo Farah and Sifan Hassan of the Netherlands set respective men's and women's world 1 hour records at the Wonder Diamond League exhibition meeting in Brussels on Friday. Britain's multi-world and Olympic champion held off challenge of his training partner, Bashir Abdi, to set a new mark of 21,330 meters, beating the 2007 mark of 21,285 meters set by Haile Gebrselassie. Abdi finished 8 meters behind. Hassan's record also came after a huge battle with Kenya's world marathon record holder, Brigid Kosgei, although it later turned out the latter had been disqualified for stepping on the infield in the closing stages. In African football, an investigation has been launched by the Egyptian Football Association after it found that several trophies have disappeared from its headquarters in Cairo. Among the trophies missing is the African Cup of Nations. Egypt received the prize after winning the 2010 edition of the tournament, winning the trophy for a third time. The trophy, whose style was first used in 2002 after Cameroon were awarded the previous cup, having won it 3 times, was given to the Egyptian Football Association by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, after winning it in 2006, 2008, and 2010. On Friday, the Egyptian Football Association confirmed the trophy's loss and said it had opened an investigation into the loss of the various trophies. CAF regulations state that a team that wins a particular incarnation of the African Cup of Nations trophy 3 times will own it for good. Ghana was the first team to win the trophy 3 times in 1978, while Cameroon received the second version of the Nations Cup trophy after becoming the first country to win it on 3 occasions. Under CAF rules, teams that win the Nations Cup receive a replica of the trophy on a permanent basis, where they are allowed to keep the trophy for the 2 years in between tournaments before handing it back. The current trophy, whose style is still the same as the one won by Egypt, is in the hands of Algeria, who won the last nation's title in Cairo last year. Meanwhile, Sadio Mane is among 4 Liverpool players on the 6-man shortlist for the Professional Footballers Association Player of the Year award. The Senegalese is the only African on the shortlist, with the Premier League champions having last year's winner Virgil van Dijk on the list, as well as Jordan Henderson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. Runners-up Manchester City are represented by Kevin De Bruyne and Raheem Sterling. As well as the main men's award, Liverpool defender Alexander-Arnold also features on the young player list. The winners will be announced on Tuesday. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
shanga sijui au tuseme nina kibwe nakata wanidai siwadai ila na shanga wananichukia chuki zisizo sababu wanatinya mbuzi kafari ili asile apote ona wanavyo mwaka he ya Mungu baba unitete wana miriki mafogi fogi wana shinana na midongote wana wish hata nishiwe kodi ni tange tange wanizome ni mnyonge nililie nani kama si wewe kisa toke wanafania waniondoe ninajikaza hivyo ninajikaza hivyo shindana nawe mpaka napiga magoti namlilia mama mama kisha narudi kwako umlaze salama sawa nyinyi manoti noti tutakutana kiyama nyonge narudi kwako kwako maurana wana chinya mbuzi kafari ili asile apote ona wanavyo mwaga he Mungu baba unitete wana miriki mafogi fogi wana shinana na midongote wana wish hata nishiwe koji ni tange tange wanizome ni mnyonge nililie nani kama si wewe kisa toke wanafania waniondoe ninajikaza hivyo ninajikaza hivyo ninajikaza hivyo ninajikaza hivyo
What shall we do?
What shall we do?
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, strawberries do not ripen according to the wishes of a baboon. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.